It's a real privilege to be with you here at Biblical once more. And it's good to hear of many of our students coming to Biblical for their graduate education. I have two sons-in-laws, and I think that's all I'm going to ever have. One has graduated from Biblical just a few years ago. His name is Louis Mealano. And presently in the student body, we have a young man by the name of Todd Manda, who just last summer became my second son-in-law. I'm thankful for the invitation to come and participate in your program. I realize that probably many of the students are beginning to study for the final exams. I didn't realize when I picked this date that I might have some competition for time, but hopefully we will have a good time together. Again, I've been receiving your biblical bulletin, and I've been reading some of the articles that some of you men have been writing in the bulletin, in fact, I read most of them. And, of course, I'm saddened by the sudden passing away of your president, and I trust the Lord will bless your search for another person to take that position. This evening I want to deal with the subject of archaeology, and my topic is really to deal with archaeology from the amateur viewpoint. And yet I hope that some things that we say will be a great challenge to all of you. So I want to begin with the use of two overlays on this side of the room, and then eventually share some slides with my projector on the other side of the room. I've had the opportunity of doing some digging in the Holy Land, working at a site called APEC, which is a very excellent biblical site, in that it had representations of all the main periods of Old Testament or biblical archaeology, beginning with very primitive, primitive and very early remains of archaeology, and then coming right down to the very present, a site that's been occupied rather heavily and repeatedly down through the years. I've also had 2 weeks of opportunity of working at Jerusalem near the Temple Mount area, southeast corner of the city. I worked there for 2 weeks, and then since then I worked a few summers when I found time with a young man by the name of Chris Hummer, who also is a grad of our school, and he teaches in the Plymouth White Marsh area now, and he is interested in archaeology. He has worked with Indian sites, and most recently we have worked near Frenchtown, New Jersey. I want to begin then with the talk about the definition of archaeology. There are many, many definitions of archaeology, and I guess we need not labor this particular point, but simply to say that archaeology is the study of the past from the remains that might be found. Or we might say it yet another way, a little bit facetiously, and say archaeology is digging in the dumps of the past. That's what people have described it. And in the summer that I worked in Israel, we were involved in uncovering quite a number of grave sites. And I guess the rabbis had known that we were finding so many grave sites, they would have stopped us, because more recently, when archaeologists were working near Jerusalem or at Ophel, the rabbis tried to hinder the work there because they felt that the archaeologists were disrupting the grave sites. And as you know, the Jews, devout Jews, have a very reverent attitude towards the burial of the dead. In fact, one of the worst things you can do, oftentimes the prophets alluded to this, would be to uproot the grave and scatter the bones of the dead over the countryside. This is something which is revolting to us, but even more revolting to the Jews. Let's talk about the nature of archaeology. We say that archaeology involves adventure and also danger. I find that more and more people are opting to get involved in archaeological work for their summer vacation. I find that sometimes people seem to be out of laws as to what they might do during the 2 or 3 weeks they might have for vacation time. And I've encountered a number of people in recent years who decided that they would get involved in archaeology. In fact, in one of the summers that I was in Israel, there was a Jewish young man who had lived in New York, but when he wanted to travel and during his vacation times, he usually would go to Israel. And so in the summer that we were there, he decided that was the summer he was going to get involved in archaeology. So he spent about 2 weeks of the summer in an archaeological dig near the Jerusalem Wall. So archaeology can be an adventure, also can involve considerable danger. There are many, many instances or examples of the danger that archaeology might present. We think of a man like Howard Carter, who in 1922 found King Tut's tomb and became famous overnight. He also was involved in recovering some of the artifacts from the tomb of Queen Hatshepsut. And the story comes down to us that he was involved in a running gun battle with some of the people of the area who had hoped to steal some of those artifacts from the tomb. Or think of a man like Hilprecht, who worked at Nippur in Mesopotamia. And his tents and his camp were destroyed by some of the Bedouins. And he himself and those who worked there had to flee for safety. We can think of a man like Nelson Glyph, who was involved in a lot of archaeological research in the Negev and in the Transjordan. On one occasion, he got lost. Lost for about 3 days and nearly died of thirst. We can think of a man like Henry Rawlinson, who was involved in the copying of the inscription on the face of the cliff in Iran. And he took a ladder and did not have much of a ledge for the standing of that ladder. And yet he climbed it and copied the inscription, much of the inscription. The inscription that he copied was one that was placed on the face of the cliff around 500 BC by Darius the Great. And the scribes who wrote the inscription, after they were finished, they then cut away the steps which led up to the face of the cliff. And so this prevented vandalism and damage to the inscription down to the year. But modern archaeologists have had the danger of trying to copy it. And they've employed steeplejacks and others to help them. And there are many others who encountered many kinds and many different types of danger as they've engaged in archaeological work. Thirdly, archaeology is composite science. And it's a science that involves the know-how of many, many different people. And again, I did not have any archaeological experience when I went to the Holy Land. But I found that working alongside with someone who had a little bit of field experience, that I was able to learn very quickly what I was supposed to do and what to look for. So that we were working in squares that were about 15 feet square, and we had roughly an average of about 4 people in each square. And so the directors of the dig tried to arrange things so there'd be at least one experienced person in each square. And this was a great help. And so after a week or two, we learned a lot of the basics. Of course, we were not professional archaeologists. But we learned a lot of the basics of the field of archaeological work. We say it's composite science. It involves the work of a chemist who might be involved in the analyzing of the soil. He might be involved in the analysis of the clay that was used to make up a piece of pottery, or the clay that was used to make up a clay tablet. And from such chemical analysis, he might be able to determine whether the clay was clay from that particular site or clay that came from some distant place. There's the help of the anthropologist that's needed. And some of that I was involved in digging in Israel. I think we were involved in digging up at least a dozen different grave sites. Many of the graves were burials of small children, but we came across a few adult burials. And I remember there were a number of times we would say, I wish that Dennis were here, or we wish that an anthropologist were here, that he would tell us a little bit more about the bones that we were uncovering. The bones that we uncovered, of course, we carefully packed away and recorded. And of course, I believe that in later times, someone did get around to examining the bones and studying them more carefully. There's the need for the help of a zoologist who would examine the bones of various animals which might be uncovered in a dig, or animal teeth that might be uncovered in a dig. Which reminds me that in that shoebox there, I brought along a few pieces of pottery which you might want to handle after we're done here. And I brought along also a Biblical Archaeology magazine, Biblical Archaeology Review, which has a fine article on some present digs, some digs that are going on this summer in Israel. And that's how I got involved in the field work of archaeology, and it turned out to be a very, very valuable experience. Prior to that, I had read quite a bit about archaeology, but I feel like I learned a lot more by being on the site And again, in some ways, it's like watching a ball game on TV and being at the ballpark. You are taken up a little bit more with the excitement of what's going on all around you. And it's a very exciting experience when you have to dig, and someone finds an unusual vase, or someone finds even maybe just a fragment of an inscription, or someone finds, say, something that was imported from afar. This creates a great deal of excitement. And you find the people that dig drop their tool, and they run to the area where the finds are made, and the one who found the object becomes a celebrity, and he's in the photographs for the whole archaeological team. Everybody comes with their cameras and takes their own pictures of a dig. As of course, the many pictures taken by professionals at the dig also, but many who are at the dig like to take some pictures of their own. There's a need for the botanist. He might study pollen. He might study grain that has been found. presently, archaeologists sometimes will take up certain samples of the soil and maybe sift it, and then put it in a tub and make a muddy mixture out of it. And as they mix up this mud from the soil that they have just dug up and let it stand for a while, they'll find that hair, sometimes fins of the fish, and things like that will float to the surface. And by the study of such things, the scientists can determine what the people were eating at that particular time in the history of the mound. There's the need for the work of the geologist. Sometimes sites are near the shore, and sometimes the geologist might be able to determine through historical studies and through his own particular science something about maybe the seashore has sunk maybe 10 feet below what it was before, or maybe 10 feet higher than it was before. I can recall visiting at Caesarea, and at the ruins of Caesarea there are some docks, ancient Roman-type docks, and it's believed that there were channels that would allow the Roman warships to come up into those docks and possibly unload their weapons secretly. But now that area is maybe 10, 15 feet above the water. And so the scientists say, the geologists say, that that has changed as a result possibly of earthquake-like disturbances. Many others can participate in the dig. The architect might study the foundations of buildings, study the foundations or the layout of a wall, study the various defenses that were part of the city's defenses at various times in history. And of course, along with the architect, there are many other sciences that are involved. Those skilled in photography can be a great help. There's a need for professional photography. And those who are artists who might make sketches of various things that are found in the dig. So in the process of digging a square, you might see a large stone. And maybe the first inclination is to take out that large stone and move it, get out of the way. But usually stone remains, because maybe that large stone is part, or say the topmost part, of a wall that goes through your part of the dig. And so whatever stones you find are left in place until you determine whether there might have been a wall there or not. And if you eventually do uncover a wall, then the artist may come in and make a sketch of that. And the photographer almost daily will come in and take pictures of the work. Again, taking pictures is a very difficult thing, especially in the Holy Land where you have a very bright sun. And so the photographers at our dig would try to get pictures of some of the ruins before the sun was very hot. And even after the sun was up, a number of us would stand on step ladders and hold a big black sheet so as to shade the whole square. So it didn't have one half of the square flooded with sunlight, and the other half of the square flooded with the darkness. Again, if you have half and half, you really won't get a very good picture of the ruins and of the square. And so tricks like this are employed by the archaeologists. Also, such things as air balloons are used. At our dig, we sometimes use simply a stepladder, enable the photographer to get a good angle on the ruin. Well, the purpose of archaeological work. I'm talking about the purpose of biblical archaeology, and there are two main purposes. First of all, to confirm our study and confirm the accuracy of the scriptures. There are many, many instances where archaeology has helped to confirm the actual scriptures. Notice I say confirm, not prove, because I don't think that, I think, lowers the scripture. We all have a very high view of the scripture. So we say archaeology confirms the accuracy of the scripture. I'm reminded of many, many examples where archaeology has helped to confirm the scriptures. We think of the references to the Hittites. We think of how the critics found fault with the mention of Belshazzar as the king of Babylon. And then later on, the critics discovered that Nabonidus was the king of Babylon. So the question came, well, how do you reconcile the two? Well, in time, the problem was reconciled, in that Nabonidus was the king. His son, in his later years, served in a co-regency. And there's no problem. There's no contradiction between historical history and the Bible. Archaeology also helps to illuminate the scriptures. In some of the slides I will share with you, will help to illustrate this. I have shown here an unusual artifact that has been found in the Holy Land. When this artifact was first found, is a cause for a lot of discussion. In fact, that's one of the fascinating aspects of archaeology. Sometimes you find things, and even professional archaeologists sometimes is stumped as to what it is. And this is an object that was a source of discussion for some time. Notice it has a spout at the top, and it has two handles here, but shaped very differently from most vessels you might find that it did. Does anyone have an idea as to what this vessel might be?
Hanging pot.
Pardon me?
A hanging pot.
Well, you're on the right track. It's the Old Testament version of a butter churn. The idea would be to suspend the butter churn on ropes via these handles, and you fill the butter churn with your sour cream, and then the lady of the house, while she might be watching the baby or rocking the crib, rocking the baby, might also be just giving us a shove back and forth until eventually you shake up enough until you've had butter. This is an old-fashioned butter churn. Again, as I say, some of these things really challenge your imagination when you see them. The next matter I might talk about in reference to archaeology is choosing a site. And I see that our time is going very quickly, so I want to speed things up a little bit. First of all, sometimes sites are chosen for the archaeologist. Sometimes construction work begins in a particular area, and as the construction work gets underway, the construction workers encounter or come across an archaeological site. In fact, there's a frequent problem in the Holy Land. In fact, builders cringe at the thought of finding something of archaeological significance, because if they buy a tract of ground and they wish to build, say, a 20-story hotel on that site, and as they begin the groundwork to discover a significant archaeological site, then that work of building may be held up for some time. Oftentimes the archaeologists are called in, and oftentimes the archaeologists must work very hurriedly, sometimes doing rather a sloppy job because of the limits of time, because the builder has invested money in that tract of ground, and he cannot really realize any income until the building is completed. And so he's concerned about the work getting underway. Again, we've had problems like this in our own country. Not too many years ago, in the Delaware Valley, they were planning to build a large dam. And a member that Chris Hummer and others that I know were invited to come in there and to do archaeological work at some Indian sites that were eventually going to be inundated by the rising flood waters. And so we have problems like that here, too. Sometimes archaeological sites are discovered by accident. And this, many examples of this too. I think of the discovery of Ras Shamra in 1928 along the coast of Syria. And their farmers, as they were plowing and working the fields, slammed into a grave site. And this was the beginning of some archaeological work. And Schaefer and others came in there and worked from 1928 on to the near the very present. And they found the Ugaritic clay tablets. Clay tablets which are very valuable to us and help to illuminate the study of the Old Testament, in that there are many words in Ugaritic that have cognates, the same word in Hebrew, And of course also it shed a great deal of light upon Hebrew poetry and also Canaanite religion. So discovery of the site of Rosh Hashanah, from which we get the tablets which we call the Ugaritic clay tablets, are a very important discovery. Sometimes places are found or excavated simply out of curiosity. It might be a site like Nineveh, or a site like Babylon, or Jerusalem itself, where people wish to know more about that site, so begin digging. Again, sometimes archaeological work becomes a byproduct of something else. I think of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And these scrolls are found near the shores of the Dead Sea, at least some of them were found near the Dead Sea. And so with that, archaeologists began to think, well, there's an archaeological site near the Dead Sea called Qumran. It was known by the archaeologists for many, many years. On the top of that mound, there was a Roman fort. And so the archaeologists did not really take that mound seriously and did not excavate it. Thinking it wasn't that important. And so the discovery of some of the scrolls nearby, then the archaeologists thought, we ought to go in there and examine that site. And so that site had been thoroughly excavated. And of course, it's been discovered that the people who lived at that site were probably involved in the copying of the scrolls and also in the hiding of the scrolls in the cave. Sometimes archaeology is involved in finding a lost city. We have the fascinating story of Heinrich Schliemann, who read Homer and read about Troy and other Greek sites. Many Greek scholars thought that some of those places were fictitious names, but Schliemann took them more literally. And so Schliemann set forth in the late 1800s and excavated at Troy. We mentioned also of the place called Ebla. Ebla was known because of its mention of the name in some of the clay tablets. And yet, no one was sure where Ebla was located. And so eventually, archaeologists from the University of Rome went to Ebla, and after excavating there for maybe 8, 10 years, maybe more, they eventually found evidence which helped to identify the site that they were working on with Ebla. And of course, the excavations at Ebla have been very exciting discoveries. Maybe not as earth-shaking as was their first thought, but I think that many history books will have to be rewritten on the basis of the finds there. Again, I may remind you of one of the problems with the archaeological work. In mind of this, I can speak about Ebla. The archaeologists who worked at Ebla are from the University of Rome. And so the artifacts that they find will go back to Rome. The clay tablets they find will go back to Rome. And so whatever experts are found at the University of Rome, they will be involved especially in the deciphering of many of the texts. Scholars around the world would wish that this work could go a lot faster. And yet, usual practice in such circumstances would be for the archaeologists simply to sit in those tablets for their long defense amen. And so those of us who are anxiously waiting for more information that might come from those clay tablets will just have to wait. Again, what will take 25 years to do, maybe even longer, could be done in 5 years if the tablets were distributed among scholars around the world. I want to talk about preparation of the dig, preparation for digging. And there are many things we could talk about here. I'm just going to limit myself just to suggest a few things. In modern times, the archaeologists do a lot of surface exploration. In fact, in the Holy Land, there might be more than 3,000 major archaeological sites. And of those archaeological sites, only maybe 200 or so have had any serious archaeological work done on them. And so, because of the lack of people, the lack of money, archaeologists are doing a lot of work in recent years in surface exploration. And this is becoming a very scientific kind of study. But in surface exploration of a site, the archaeologists will come in with maybe a team of 10 or 20 of his students, and we'll examine the site, just simply examine the things they can find on the surface, and maybe spend maybe a week at the site and then go on to other sites. But by surface exploration, the archaeological expert can learn quite a bit about the remains and the occupation of that site down through the years. Again, as a site stands there, the remains of the ancient mound, the rain, the weather eventually caused the erosion of pottery and artifacts that eventually will show up on the surface. And those who are trained in surface exploration can learn a lot about the ancient site. Aerial photos, of course, are a great help. I think here of a photograph that I've seen of a Etruscan excavation. And with aerial views taken from airplanes or helicopters and the use of certain kinds of film, the archaeologists can locate the various sites on the ground. We know that I was brought up as a farm boy, and I know that in certain places where the plow turns up the subsoil, the clay, the grain or the grass may be discolored, and the grain or the grass will not be as tall as the grain that grows in the fertile and deep soil. Again, sometimes with the aerial view, you can see the outline of a building foundation because the soil has been turned up, and or the soil is shallow at that point, and thus the grain is discolored. And the archaeologist, sometimes from the aerial viewpoint, can see that, but he doesn't see that so quickly when standing on the ground. And then literary research is helpful preparation for a dig. Archaeologists working in the vicinity of Jerusalem will, of course, very basic as far as literary research, will be the Bible itself. And so the archaeologist must know his Bible thoroughly as he engages in the archaeological work. But then the works of men like Josephus and Eusebius, Jerome, and others will make mention of various buildings, various sites in their historical records. Their records must be studied very carefully and oftentimes can shed light upon the archaeological work. Then we have the problem of dating the past. And there are various ways in dating the past. In Mesopotamia, archaeologists have found clay tablets which have king lists on them. And these king lists, the discovery of number of king lists and comparison of these king lists, helps determine the dates for some of the kings of ancient Mesopotamia and of ancient Sumer and other parts of the ancient world. Histories are important. There are people in ancient times who take upon themselves to write historical records. We know a lot about ancient Egyptian history from an Egyptian historian by the name of Manetho, who wrote in the 3rd century BC, and many others that we might cite. I just mentioned just these few. So the study of the history, like Manetho, would be especially helpful to one who's working in Egyptian archaeology. Historical events that can shed light upon our study of history. We think, for example, of how the Egyptians sometimes record some of their military exploits on the walls of their temple. I think of how Ramses II went up to war against the Hittites around the 1286 BC and famous battle of Kadesh. Again, there's a historical event that was mentioned on the walls of temples in Egypt. And so as archaeologists work at sites like Kadesh, they can approach the dig with that background. There's pottery chronology that helps in dating the past. Of course, pottery, since it was used over a wide span of man's history, and since pottery, once it's been baked, is almost indestructible in the ground. And so the pottery is a great help. Just like your great-grandmother might go to her cupboard and take down a cup and saucer that might be some very beautiful English china, and she can tell you quite the story behind this, where it was made, who in the family had it before she had it. So also the biblical archaeologists can take a piece of pottery and can tell you just sometimes with a fragment of what the vessel may have looked like. The archaeologist does not necessarily have to have a complete vessel to give you a pretty good idea of what the vessel may look like. There's radioactive dating, the various forms of radioactive dating. I guess most familiar to us would be the carbon-14 dating, which may be helpful in dating organic substances, bone and wood. The paleography, the study of ancient writing. Again, as you look at the inscriptions, script writing changes down through the years. And so those who are experts in the study of writing, by their knowledge of the writings, by the style of writing that they see, can quickly determine the date of those writings. So that a man like Albright, when he first had a look at some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, was able very quickly to say they belong to a period around 100 BC. Subsequent research has not really changed it that much, because Albright was such an expert in many fields of archaeology, including the writing. Then coins can be helpful in dating. Sometimes coins found in the level in which you're digging may help date that particular level. When we were digging at Jerusalem, we found quite a few coins, but as we took the coins out of the ground, they were covered with rust and corrosion. And so they were sent to the laboratory at the university. Unfortunately, there were too many steps between the finding of the coins and eventually determining what was on the coin. And they never got back to us and said, the coin you found yesterday was a very valuable or unusual coin. I think if that kind of communication could take place, we would dig that much more diligently. I might add that sometimes digging can be very, very boring. And there are days that go by when you don't really find anything of significance. And other days, which are indeed very exciting. All right, that's all we want to do with the overhead. I guess I should go on quickly to the slides, and then if there's any time for questions, we can try to handle them then. All right, this is just a map of the Holy Land. The blue dot pinpoints Jerusalem, and then to the northwest of the blue dot we have Aphek and Patras. And Aphek was on the ancient Via Mars, the ancient international trade route that joined Africa with Asia. Of course, we're reminded here of the importance, the strategic importance and the strategic location of the Holy Land, located on that land bridge between Asia and Africa, and even serves the land bridge between Africa and Europe. This is a mound at Beersheba. I brought that, included this picture in this set of slides just to give you an idea of a cut that might be made into the side of the mound. I'll show you a close-up in the next picture of the same cut made into the side of the mound at Beersheba. Archaeologists from Tel Aviv University have worked here quite diligently for the last 10, 15 years. It's hope of eventually setting up a archaeological museum right on the very site. Archaeologists discovered that at certain periods the street plan at the site of Beersheba was an oval or circular street plan with houses and shops on either side of the street. And the street was really an oval shaped street on the very top of the mound. As you look at the cut, you notice that you see stones in the foreground, which part of an outer wall that once around the city, and then beyond that you see additional stones in the inner part of the wall. You see that at one time these stones helped to fortify the city of Beersheba. The mound of Beersheba is located in the plains of Negev. Presently, modern Beersheba, you might say, is the capital of the Bedouin country in Israel. And of course, remember Beersheba because of the visits there, especially by Abraham. This is our archaeological site at Aphek, Aphek and Patras. The buildings that you see were buildings that were erected by the British during the time that they held a mandate in the Holy Land from about 1920 to about 1948. And they built a military camp here because near Aphek there were some very important water sources, and so the military was stationed here to protect those water sources from poison and other vandalism. So we set up a military encampment. The buildings that we stayed in then were barracks, and we erected also a few tents. Just to the left center of the picture, you see the reviewing stand, where the military officer could stand and watch the maneuvers of his troops. Before any serious archaeological work can get started, the surveyor must come in and must mark off raised areas for excavation. I was involved in working on the north side of the mound, which is called Area A. And there were five or six different areas where we were excavating at the same time. That is, I would work at Area A and only Area A, but other groups of archaeologists and workers would work at Area B and G and other parts of the mound. The mound of Apec is a mound of about 35 acres in size. And the mound was purchased by a nearby city to use it as a, eventually, use the ground as a city park. So while we were engaged in archaeological work, nearby there were bulldozers and trucks working, filling wet areas and building roads, so eventually the area could be used as a city park. So the mound itself will eventually become a museum, a tourist attraction, I believe, for the town of Tatatikla in the Holy Land. The surveyor must find the highest point on the mound. At Apec, the highest point on the mound was the floor of an old mosque, and that was, like I said, a zero point. And so with the aid of his transit and his surveying equipment, he then will mark out the various areas for digging. So we might suppose that this might be 9 meters below that zero point, and then having that record at the corner of the square where we would dig, we then keep a careful record of our progress in the soil day by day. This is how the site looked the first day that came out to begin the work. We were told to be very careful not to put our bare hands into the bushes because of the wildlife that might be there. In the first day of being at this site, we encountered a few scorpions and a small snake, which we very quickly killed, and then discovered it was a harmless snake. But in the Holy Land, there are vipers, snakes whose bite can be very, very dangerous. When I visited the Holy Land in some of the tours with the Philadelphia College of Bible, my first visit to the Holy Land was back in 1971, I was disappointed when I came to places like Lakish and Caesarea and saw the erosion and find that brush and undergrowth was growing up around some of these archaeological sites. Some might say, here's where they found the foundations of an ancient temple. And it took a great deal of imagination to see it or to vision that. And so you see here, just in one winter of snow and rain, you see how the vaults have collapsed, large stones and lava soil have rolled down to the square. And so as the work begins, this is how the site looked after 3 summers of digging. And so if you came to the site for the 4th summer, we had to clear away the erosion, first of all. So you see our team of workers removing the soil so that sometimes in the eroded soil you might find something of significance and we keep a record of it, but the more serious archaeological work could not go on until the erosion had been cleared away and take the squares down strata by strata, level by level. Our day would begin around 5 o'clock in the morning. This large truck rim served as our alarm clock, and we wake up around 5 o'clock, rush to the washrooms, wash up, and then we go to the dining hall with a cup of tea or coffee and a slice of jelly bread, and then we went to the tool shed and got our tools, the wheelbarrow, the workman's pick, the tabia, the shovel-like instrument, brushes and trowels, ice picks, and paintbrushes. These were the tools that we used most frequently out in the field. You see men working at moving a large rock that goes down to the square. In the background, you see that swampy area where you have some of the water sources that are near the mound. You see that after 2 or 3 days of working at the site, the squares are fairly level in their floor, and also the walls or vaults are fairly vertical in their stand. And so now serious archaeological work can continue on. The professional archaeologist likes to see level floors wherever possible and vertical and smooth walls. And so the workers in the field work a lot with their trowels and try to maintain this. The professional archaeologist reads the walls of the square.
And you can see where there might be a plaster floor, or where maybe there is a pebble floor that you can see in the wall, or the bulk of the square. And this is something that is very important to the research. Also, if there's, say, a plaster floor, maybe you might see where the plaster floor has been broken through. So the question comes, why is that plaster floor broken through in some kind of ancient past? It may be it's broken through to create a burial site. Or maybe it's broken through to create a place to use for dumping. And so these are things that the archaeologist looks for in his digging. Again, we say the archaeologist reads the square. Again, this is the trained eye of the archaeologist. It's like a trained eye of the dentist who can take an x-ray picture of your decayed tooth. And he might show you where he sees decay and he shows it to you. But usually, I'm not able to follow him. Like, I don't see the decay that he sees there. But anyway, he says, here's the decay, and we have to go after that. I lived in this square for about four weeks, middle of a very hot summer. And I was not involved, we were not involved in this square. We were not involved in finding very much that seemed very significant. We were finding brick wall. Really, it was a good lesson for me. But nearby, they're finding some very nice vessels and very nice artifacts, and that I found more fascinating. Eventually, we found a little juglet. This I found, you can see the juglet was standing upside down on the ground. My pick went through the very bottom of it. I damaged that with my pick. But after hitting that, then I knew to slow down and move the incrustations that were all around it with the ice pick and the paintbrush. And we got to the place where we had removed from the ground, and then we got this picture. Here's the same vessel. Unfortunately, the handle and the rim or spout that it might have had are no longer on it. But a very nicely burnished vessel, and must have been a rather attractive vessel when it was first made. But we were working especially in what's called the Middle Bronze II period, Middle Bronze 2B period, which goes back to around 1700 BC. So many of the things that we found were close to 4,000 years old. Here you see where a large jug was damaged by our picks, and then within that large jug, there was a small juglet. In the summer of that I was involved in digging in Israel, I met a young man from United Wesleyan College. His name is Barry Ross. And since he has left there to go to Azusa College, he's now working as a missionary in Japan. Here's a small juglet that appears to be perfect, preserved in the ground for a long, long time. These are remains of adult burial. Here you see an unusual bowl and an even more unusual a small jar that is located in the bowl of a square. The professional archaeologists didn't like us to go into the vault to dig things out. But when we found things like that, we were anxious to dig them out of the wall if we could. Eventually, we would take them out of the wall. And so you see the bowl that I chipped the rim with my pick, but covered the pieces, and you see the restored bowl on the right. A few days before that, I recovered the bowl you see on the left, sort of deep dish. With the four little ledge handles near the rim of the dish or the bowl. And so this is a vessel again, very typical of Canaanite pottery from about 1700 BC. And again, even before I had this completely removed from the ground, I turned to Ruth Miriam's book and found the picture of this same kind of vessel in her study of archaeology. Here you see a large storage jar, which is on the side. These storage jars have rounded bases. I guess they were placed in little sockets in the ground, or maybe little sockets made in wood or something to keep them standing erect. But this is a large storage jar, and this is being excavated while I was working with brick walls nearby. And of course, this was much more exciting to me. Here's a picture of the storage jar just before the pieces were taken up and cataloged and taken up to eventually be restored. the number of the square in which this vessel is found is number 541. We're looking east to take the picture, and the number is 2.7 meters, the second day of July of summer 1974. There's a large storage jar. Now the open storage jar, inside, you see the skull of a small child. Just above the letter E, you see the upper teeth, and just above the number 41, 541, above 41, you see the full lower jaw of the skeleton. A small child, maybe he's 6 or 7 years of age. Again, here's where you need the expert, the anthropologist, or maybe the dentist, to pinpoint the actual age of the child. We found a number of burial jars that say the Canaanites had the custom of burying stillborn infants or children that lived just for a few days. They oftentimes be buried in burial jars. So the storage jar, which may have been cracked or damaged, would then serve as a burial jar for the Canaanite people. This picture illustrates what was done. If the mouth of the jar was not large enough, it would be broken away and enlarged so that the body of the child could be stuck inside. You would sometimes find a jugglet or a bowl buried inside the jar, or sometimes near the mouth of the burial jar, which suggests to us that the Canaanites believed that the spirit of the dead stayed close to the body for some time after death. In fact, we find that there's a rather common belief among many people in ancient times, the thought of death as a weakened state of existence. And so they felt the need to bring water, to bring food, or sometimes to bury water or food near the mouth of the dead. So this kind of thing we encountered many times in archaeology. Here you have a small burial jar, and you see a few bones. In some instances, the bones of an infant might disintegrate completely. This is a cultic vessel. We found two or three of these cultic vessels that go back to Israelite times. And when, after discovering a few of these, when we showed them to the director of the dig, a big smile came across his face, because I think he's anticipating, maybe someday we'll find the foundations of a very significant temple at the site of Aphek. Cultic vessel, a vessel used in the rituals and worship. Here you see a vessel that was imported, probably from Cyprus. So archaeological work shed a great deal of light upon trade, commerce that went on at various periods of time. Trade with Egypt, trade with Cyprus, trade possibly with the Greek mainland. Here another vessel, probably from Cyprus. In the middle of summer of 1974, we came across what we call an Iron Age dump. The archaeologists from Tel Aviv University were especially involved with dig, and also from Baylor and from Warren Buckley Seminary. And as they were involved in the dig in the previous summers, they found evidence of Canaanites, they found evidence of New Testament occupation and Roman occupation at the site. They didn't find anything that shed light upon Israelite occupation at Aphek. And yet we read about Aphek and the war between the Philistines and the Israelites at the Battle of Amnesia and so on. That was near Aphek. And so Aphek was occupied by the Philistines at times and also occupied by the Israelites. And so in the middle of summer, we came across this part of the dig, and we found all kinds of pottery going back to Israelite times. So I was glad to be there. Again, in previous summers, they came within 6 feet of discovering the Israelite type of pottery, but yet they missed it by 6 feet. Again, I think that many, many valuable artifacts could be found at many archaeological sites. Archaeologists have missed them, possibly by just a few feet. And yet that's what happens in archaeological work. This young man is uncovering an Israelite lamp that's upside down in soil. This is what the lamp might look like. Again, in study of lamps that come down to us, oil lamps that come down to us, so the archaeologists can demonstrate the development, so to say, the evolution, to use that, pardon that expression, the evolution of the lamp from ancient times to the very present, the oil lamp. And that's a very fascinating study. In fact, If you wish, you can look for archaeologists in here, you can buy modern oil lamps that are replicas of the ancient oil lamps. Here's some of the finds that were found in this Iron Age site, probably going back to 800, 900 BC. Here, just a foot and a half beneath the surface, you can see seven or eight large vessels with various degrees of uncovering them. And so we found these in this square, and we quickly started other square nearby, and again found pottery in abundance, again just a foot and a half beneath the surface. Here a vessel that's been restored. Here's some pottery that we had set up in one of the barracks. One of the barracks became our museum. In fact, the barracks were our first stage. And we were forced out because they felt they needed a building that they could lock up and keep some of the pottery. One day, to speed up the work of the excavation, the bulldozer that was involved in road building, the bulldozer driver was asked to come over to the mound, and the director of the dig took him to a part of the mound where no work had been done before. So the bulldozer made a cut, just the width of the bulldozer blade, and down about 3 or 4 feet into the ground, and went smacking to a late bronze tomb. And these are some of the artifacts that were found on that day. So that day, the bulldozer driver had the greatest excitement. As you look at the lower right corner, you see a flat black piece of metal. That's a bronze mirror. Mirrors were made of bronze in those days. Highly polished, so you can see your reflection. You see a small sword or large dagger next to it. In the second picture, you see a vessel standing on a tripod, and that's a frying pan. We'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. But just to the right of the frying pan, you see three juglets that are not perfectly round, but somewhat flattened, and they have each have a double handle. These are what are called pilgrim flasks. In ancient times, they were used like we use the canteen. These would be carried on your belt, or be fastened by ropes over the back of the camel, or over the back of the donkey. And so these serve like like we use the canteen today. In this picture, we see a frying pan. Deeper, when we think of frying pans, we think of a flat-based vessel. But this vessel, rather deep, but yet the frying pan. Notice the wishbone-shaped handle to dissipate the heat. Dissipate the heat from the frying pan. I'm going to hurry here, and I still haven't gone away from here. Here's where the bulldozer made the cut. And a number of things were found there. We showed you some of the things were found there. And here, one of the directors of the dig, using a metal detecting device to find whatever can be found that might be metallic. Here you see some large clay balls, about maybe a little bit larger than a softball. They had a hole through some of them. Somebody asked me, did I know what they were? Well, being inexperienced, I had to say I did not know. But these clay balls were loom weights. A loom would have the strands of vertical strands of material, and also then you'd read through the horizontal strands. I forget which is the warp and the roof. But anyway, these loom weights would be fastened to the vertical strand of material. A knot would be tied, the strand material would go through the weight, and then a knot would be tied. This would keep the strand material taut. You'd have maybe 30 or 40 of these at the bottom of the loom. This would keep the material straight and tight, so you can work the material through the vertical strand. So these are loom weights. Here, a very nice vessel. You notice this is a clay vessel, but yet in the vessel, where the handles are would be fastened, you have rivet-like structures. Again, for such a vessel, it becomes decorative, but not really necessary. But again, reflects the fact that at the same time in history, there were bronze vessels made, and the handles would be fastened with a rivet. But the clay handles did not need to be fastened with rivets. But nevertheless, they were still added. A very nice vessel. This made a very nice fruit bowl if it had been perfectly preserved. Originally, it wasn't a very nice vessel. This is a vessel that I found very fascinating. This is called a false spout jar. This would have close to your cooking area. You might have oil in the jar. You use the juglet that's standing in the false spout as a dipper. So you lower that into a large jar, draw out some oil, pour the oil in your frying pan, and then pour the excess back in the jar. I thought this was very fascinating. So this picture I bought at a museum. when I saw this vessel. This is a light type vessel. Notice there are usually three handles that go from the shoulder of the vessel up to near the rim. And so this is called a four-spout jar. 2 weeks after seeing this museum, I found one that did. That made my summer for me. Good. It really did. And here are pictures of it. The vessel was not perfectly preserved. About one-fourth of the bottom of it was gone. I could not find the pieces for it. In the lower right corner, you see the full spout. The spout serving as a shelf for the jug. Here is one of the vessels. I think this is the vessel that I uncovered. I showed you this in the bulk of the square some 20 pictures back. But this turned out to be an unusual find because of the unusual painting on the shoulder of the vessel. While some are working out in the field, a small team of workers must stay back at the headquarters and scrub the pottery. The pottery is fine, replaced in plastic buckets. We soak it in water overnight. The next day, a number of workers must take a scrubbing brush and scrub the incrustations off the pottery. And this is very tedious, but the rest must be done. And then in the afternoon, we took time for pottery sorting and pottery cataloging. And in some picture, you see a lady who got a PhD at Columbia University, and a man on the left just got his PhD from one of the Israeli universities. And so these are two pottery experts, and they're going through a pottery that has been dug out of the ground, has been washed, and is dried. And now they're going through a pottery that seems of value. They will put in a bag or a box and catalog it and keep. And again, it's amazing to watch them at work. They can take a small piece of pottery that might be no more than 2 or 3 inches square and say, this belongs to a vessel that looks like this, or a vessel that belongs like this. And then turn to the textbook. And so I must mention, here you see pottery restoration. The glue that's used for bringing the piece together is usually a soft glue, so if the piece is put in the wrong way, you hopefully can break it away and start over again. Here's the work of the artist, making a sketch of the vessel that's on the table in front of him. Here's on the walls. So the archaeologist knows a lot about many aspects of ancient site. The defenses, the trade, what they ate, who occupied the site at various times. There's many things that are brought to light by the archaeological research. Here's something that was a puzzle to the archaeologist. You see some clay liners in the ground. At first glance, you might say these are ovens, and so suggested this was a place where they had a bakery. And then a few weeks later, they said, no, probably wasn't a bakery, maybe it's a place where they had a store. And these were underground silos where you might store grain or other potatoes, whatever. And then they changed, a few years later, they changed that guess. And now they're suggesting that this was a place where they made soap. Or dyed garments. And again, the basis of the study of the area, they found that certain chemicals and certain nitrates that might be used in making soaps were found in abundance in that area. And maybe another site, they found something similar and concluded that it was possibly something to do with soap making. And so now that's the latest suggestion that I know of for this particular site. But sometimes the archaeologists must guess. Coming down to the last picture, this is another exciting find. Again, this is shows the remains of a large public building that was found at Aphek. And this building goes back to the days of Joshua's conquest of the Holy Land. And some of the artifacts were found in conjunction with this suggested that this burning probably took place in the days of Joshua's conquest. And so you see beneath the surface, about a foot and a half of the surface, you see a white plaster floor. That's probably not of any great archaeological significance. But then below that, you see layers of burned brick, and then ash layers, and then burned brick again. And this covered a rather wide area, evidence of a large public building, and is assumed at that point that that building was probably destroyed by Joshua's forces when he took Aphek. All right, that's all I have. Just in conclusion then, you see that archaeology, something that all of us can just reasonable. And we may not be experts, but if we are skilled in entering the field, And usually that expertise can be employed and be utilized very effectively at a date. Again, if you have had no field experience before, again, if you volunteer, you can learn some basics of archaeological work within 2 days and can make a very vital contribution to the work. Thank you very much.
When you say the last picture of Ur Level B Joshua, are you dating that to 1200s? Generally, that's where the archaeologists would date.
I forget the date that they were giving for that. Again, I'm not sure that the archaeological remains there would, say, point towards an early date for Joshua's conquest or for a late date for Joshua's conquest. That part I'm not very sure of. I just know that they, Joshua and that conquest and that destruction. So whether they're thinking in terms of a 1500 or 1275 or just what, I'm not sure.
What means is that you've determined the best painting things of literature as much as possible?
I think that, I'm not sure exactly what they use to determine that. I didn't hear that whole story. But, the loop handle at the very top, of course, allows the center from the supports of your tent or from the ceiling of your stuff, of your home. And again, I guess maybe finding possibly some similar vessels, maybe in Greek ruins or in other parts of the world, it actually led the archaeologists to include that in the
large. How large was the opening in the top of that?
I would say about 2 inches. Well, again, it'd have to be fairly large, and we get the butter out.
That's right. That's what I was thinking.
I think the picture I showed showed you rather narrow. I think that some do come, that normally it would be maybe 3 inches in diameter, maybe larger, so that the butter couldn't be moved without too much difficulty. My drawing is very not exactly as it should be. It should be a little bit larger that help you see that. But again, it may be that At first, the butter churn was a puzzle to the archaeologists. Mm-hmm. But again, as archaeological research goes on, various places around the world, various conscience might say, eventually lead to the conclusion that this undoubtedly was the butter churn.
Yeah, well, we know the churn, all right, somewhere.
Yes, they had some way to do it, yes. And again, with the showing of the oven, again, it's thought that might be bakery. There were about 10 of those found in close, an area maybe about the south of the room. And so they said, that might have said it's a bakery for community, rather than having all bakery, a bakery for community. And then they said, no, this might be a store. And then say, well, maybe we can do a sewing. Or maybe even a vats that might be used for dyeing clothing. Again, that's a more possible. And of course, when it comes to things like that, other digs nearby where might have something of similar nature, and they shed light on it. And also, of course, knowing something of what was going on, what were some of the industries? For example, if there's a lot of textile, if there were all sheep and goats raised in that area, and if it's known from ancient history that they made a lot of wool garments, then it has to do with the dyeing of the garments or the washing of the garments and so on. So the archaeologists oftentimes is grasping for straws and trying to piece together the puzzle that he has uncovered. And then there are illustrations of that. I can play privately some of those. I don't want to hold all of you. The other questions?
Was there any attempt to discover if the pottery had writing on it by the washing? Were they careful in the washing too?
In the summer that I was at APEC, that was the first summer that they found a few fragments of clay tablets. And further study showed that some of the clay tablets had some Sumerian on them, along with the possible Canaanite dialect. And that, of course, was a very exciting discovery because at that time in history, only some 20-some fragments of clay tablets had been found in the Holy Land. Finding about 100,000 in Mesopotamia, yet the Holy Land, up until 1974, only 20-some inscriptions of clay tablets had been found. And so to find two in that summer was very exciting. And then in subsequent summers, a few more fragments, I forget now the present total, might be 8 or 10, that have been found at APEC. So we found these two fragments, though, and that was, of course, a great excitement. There was a hope that we might find a library or some archives. And of course, that would help to supplement what we know about, APEC and the Bible and whatever, and from say the days of Herod and maybe some later Roman records, or maybe records of about Eusebius might be a mention of APEC. But again, if you have the archives, say, from 1500 BC, that particular time, that would be a great help in knowing a lot more about APEC. Unfortunately, not many of those have been found. A few more, which has a difference. But if the archaeologists could find a few hundred tablets, that would be very, very significant.
The reason why the University of Rome is so obsessive about the separate tablets?
Yes, this is the usual practice. This is the usual practice as far as archaeological is concerned. And just recently, I read something about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Some of the earliest Dead Sea Scrolls, should say, are the modern year. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls were found years back, I think some of you know about that. But anyway, in 1948, in the beginnings of the modern era, as far as Dead Sea Scrolls are concerned, and so fragments of scrolls are being found up until the very present. A lot of work is being done in some of the schools and museums back there in Israel. And just recently I read where some of the scholars, various parts of the world, were complaining. Some of those individuals who have a collection of scrolls to work on, they really haven't gotten around to working on that. And so there's more and more pressure being brought to bear on this. And I hope that, we can get some people to move, either publish what they're working on or else give it up and let somebody else work on it. There are many, many young PhD grant candidates who would love to work on some of these projects, and they can't come back to some.
I've heard the University of Pennsylvania has thousands of plate tablets in their base.
They've sat on for a long time too. The University of Pennsylvania has done a lot of work at NITPOR and other sites in the Middle East, especially NITPOR. And again, many of the tablets are locked up in the basement. Dr. Kramer worked on many of them, but again, it'd be good if those tablets had been shared with some of the students. And actually, he did share some of the tablets with the students. So Evan Gordon and others have worked on some of the ancient proverbs of ancient Sumer, for example. But again, this work could be speeded up tremendously. But again, I think that there's a great deal of theology that's involved here. I've heard some of these professional men, I'm talking about another professional man, another school, actually curse his foul language in describing them. And, because they are sitting on the tablets and not discussing them and publishing them for various other reasons. A lot of professional jealousy that is demonstrated among some of these scholars. So that in their education and their abilities, they're really tremendous, yet in their personality and their own nature, they're very much like children.
Yeah, I think Dr. Newman was the last one of the pieces of Dropkick a few years ago. Was a translation or interpretation of a large number of fragments that they had for about 40 years.
Yes, yes. They have some interesting collections in archives. And again, if these are opened up to the scholars more generally, this would be, some of these things could be worked on and be published.
Well, that's nice to